It's always so nice to be up here on a Sunday. I haven't spoken here in a little while. It's great to be back. Those of you who've heard me before know I try not to speak very long, and have some time at the end for questions or discussion if anyone has anything they'd like to say. So I've been thinking a lot about Steve Jobs for the last month. Some of you probably saw that we have his name on the altar. Of course, his name and his face were everywhere the week and the weeks after he died. I'd only met him once, I think almost exactly 25 years ago. But I always heard about him a lot because he was a student of our founding teacher, Coben, as I was. And I always assumed that I would see him again eventually, that our paths would cross, particularly before Coben passed away, but even afterwards. I thought about contacting him to come up for the 10th anniversary of Coben's death that's coming up next summer. And for the last couple weeks, I read the biography of Steve Jobs that's been published. And it's interesting, so it mentions Coben a few times. And Coben was a big part of his life. When he was quite young, before he became at all famous or successful, Steve spent about half a year in India on a sort of pilgrimage. And when he came back, he was seriously considering just moving to Kyoto and becoming a monk. And it was Coben who talked him out of that and told him to stay and start this company, Apple, which he did. That was a long time before I knew Coben. But they were still connected after I knew him. And in fact, because I was also in the high-tech industry, Coben would talk about Steve sometimes when I saw him. And right before I was ordained, Coben told me this story that Steve had come recently to talk to him to ask if he should go back to Apple. This was during the time when Steve was not there. And Coben told him not to this time, told him that he should just focus on his family and retire. So that time Steve didn't listen to Coben. So I guess one of the things about him was that somehow he knew when to listen to his teacher and when not to. So one of the really interesting things about his biography, it does talk a lot about his practice, and I guess The Autobiography of a Yogi was Steve Jobs' favorite book, was the only book that he kept on his own iPad. One of the last trips he took before he died was to Kyoto to show his daughter the Zen gardens and the temples there. But the other thing that the biography talks about a lot is that Steve doesn't seem to have been a very nice person. There are many, many stories of him being quite cruel to people. The biographer puts it very diplomatically. There's this sentence that Steve was a man whose Zen training never quite produced in him a Zen-like calm. And that seems to be about right. One of his early girlfriends is more direct, who called him an enlightened being who was cruel. And that's just really gotten me thinking over the last week or so about how is that really possible? Can you really be both enlightened and cruel? And shouldn't this practice that we do, that we've been doing this morning, that some of us have been doing for a very long time, shouldn't it make us a better person, a nicer person? Our great teacher, Dogen, asked this question a little differently. He was concerned with this question of, if the Buddha taught us that we're all inherently enlightened, that we're all Buddhas, why don't people act enlightened? Why do we need to practice? Dogen was something of a Buddhist prodigy. He was ordained at a very young age, I think 13, and studied with many of the great masters of Japan. He received Dharma transmission from a famous Rinzai master. But he still felt throughout all his training in Japan that no one was really able to answer this basic question. If we're all basically enlightened, why do we need to do anything at all? Why do we need to practice? Why do we need to make so much effort? And after traveling around Japan for a long time, he decided there was actually no one in Japan who knew the answer. And so he took what at the time was a fairly dangerous journey to China. And in his writings, he tells us that in China, he finally found his answer. And his answer was that enlightenment is not so much a state of being as an experience. He wrote, "Although this inconceivable Dharma is abundant in each person, it is not actualized without practice, and it is not experienced without realization." And he basically repeated this message over and over again and refined it throughout his teachings. Probably his most famous writing is the Genjo Koan. There he says it like this: "When you ride in a boat and watch the shore, you might assume that the shore is moving. But when you keep your eyes closely on the boat, you can see that the boat moves. Similarly, if you examine myriad things with a confused body and mind, you might suppose that your mind and nature are permanent. But when you practice intimately and return to where you are, it will be clear that nothing at all has unchanging self." And so it isn't exactly that practice makes us enlightened, but it allows us to experience this enlightenment that we all already have. So to say someone is an enlightened being who's cruel, well, we're all enlightened beings. Koban and Suzuki Roshi, and many of the other teachers who brought Zen to America, also talked about similar sorts of things. Suzuki particularly emphasized that we sit just to experience sitting, just to have that experience that we've all had this morning, without what he called any gaining idea. And so our effort should just be focused on this experience. When we feel a goal arise, what Suzuki calls in some of his writings, when we feel something extra creeping in, all our effort should focus on returning to that pure practice, just that experience of sitting. And Koban also talked about this. One of his talks on the aspects of sitting, he says, "We don't do this practice expecting to obtain something by doing it. This is a very different kind of action. In one sense, it's quitting human business and going to the other side of the human realm." And I think that's a very hard lesson to remember, that we don't practice to become enlightened. We don't practice to become anything. But that through practice, we can experience enlightenment. And that through our actions, we can manifest enlightenment. So we're all enlightened beings, whether we're cruel or not. But when we are cruel, we are not manifesting that enlightenment. And we're not experiencing that enlightenment in that moment. And practice is just what it sounds like. It's practice. I think of it sometimes as like riding a bike with training wheels. It's a chance to experience enlightenment in this sort of simplified setting with fewer distractions, to just experience who we are without so much external stimulus pulling us away from the moment. And once we've done that, then we can try to experience it and manifest it every day. We can take the training wheels off. Of course, this is very hard. And I never practiced with Steve Jobs. Maybe some of you did. But it seems he did have a hard time manifesting this enlightenment in some aspects of his life. And I think that really shows the challenge for all of us, even after a lifetime of practice, to find ways to keep experiencing it outside the Zendo and keep manifesting it, even when it's difficult. Because I think when we are experiencing that enlightenment in ourselves, compassion and empathy just sort of arise naturally. And I think we find that we're, in those moments, we're not cruel. So thank you for taking the time this morning to manifest your own enlightenment with all of us.
Yeah, thank you for speaking about Steve Jobs. This is, I wonder also though if, so he might have been cruel, but how about to the, how did he function? How did he relate with his chief designers and his, there must have been a real vitality and synergy that happened with it. Have you heard anything of that aspect of his?
I think a lot of people loved working with him. I think he had a lot of energy, as you say, vitality, a lot of ideas. And my sense is that he was very inspired in some ways by Zen and sort of the simplicity of the Zen aesthetic. There are lots of stories about him living almost without any furniture because he just liked things very simple. And I think he, of course, loved his family and manifested compassion in those relationships.
Come to mind, but I was briefly impressed with his wife, Lorena Powell, sorry. Anyway. When a while back I tried to interest the Jobs in some material I put on the Kobun Sama website. And And I happened to leave a phone message at their house, and she responded by email and made some very nice comments about it, about saying that she could hear Coben's voice through my words. Mm-hmm. You know, and the little bit I've heard about her is that she seems wonderful to me. And so I just wanted to say that she's still here, you know. And she is a very wonderful person, and my impression is much more wonderful than Steve.
Some practicing at the Zendo in Mountain View, Busque, and he had his wonderful Zen temple there. Is partly financed because of Steve's contribution, and Les apparently he gave a talk on Steve Jobs a couple of weeks ago, and a lot of high tech. Younger generation came to visit and sit and listen to him. It was a packed house. And he brought up something really interesting about a question that apparently Steve posed to him, which was, what is work? Mm-hmm. And Les is I guess he's been involved in the high-tech industry also. Long ago, and got more into marketing, but nevertheless, he couldn't answer this question, and yet it stuck in his mind. And he basically, I believe, what brought out into the open was that this question was paramount in his design. That what made his design so wonderful, of course, is his user-friendly interface, and one of the persons in the audience posed a question, which was, what would all the iPod, the iTablet, all the things that were created, if they were created by Microsoft, what would they look like? So I thought that was really interesting.
Just to counter or to maybe balance the cruelty, there was no aspect of that in the documentary, which was purely praising Steve and honoring him, and it showed all kinds of aspects of his character that were very, very endearing. So I think he was just another very wonderful person, but just a person.
Yeah, I think very complicated. Yeah.
To touch on cruelty, if it comes up in experience, what's the best way to experience it or hold it, or how to like learn from it if it's not good or bad?
When you say if it comes up, do you mean if you find yourself being cruel or someone being cruel around you?
If one is sitting or yeah, either or, being cruel or being just in the experience.
Well, I think taking a step back, trying to see where that cruelty comes from. I think the Buddha taught that the root of these of cruelty is really illusion, that there's attachment to something that's not real, And so I think trying to step back and seeing what is that illusion or that attachment that's behind the cruelty or that's giving rise to the cruelty can sometimes be helpful. And sometimes when you see that, then it sort of, the cruelty starts to evaporate when you see the that the root is something that's not real. And when you see it in others, I think similarly, you can ask yourself, what's the suffering that's behind that cruelty? What is the attachment to illusion that they might be feeling that's giving rise to it? And I think often that then leads in ourselves to a compassion for that person. Because there's something at the root of it that they can't see, at least not in that moment.
I'm curious about this compassion business. And in this same story here, because I don't understand it, but it seems as though I suffer when I have compassion. When I sense what you just said, which is behind the cruelty, I see a person suffering. And with my sense of that compassion, in a way I empathize and suffer also. So it's... tricky business, this compassion, for me, at least.
Well, I agree. I think empathy is, it can be painful. But I think that's part of the root of what we call the Bodhisattva vow, that basically it's impossible for each of us to be fully happy or at peace or free of suffering as long as others are suffering. And that's just part of the connectedness of people. So it can be... painful, but I think it's just a natural result of being here and being part of this world. And it can help motivate us to practice, to help others. So it has its function, but I think you're right that it can be very, very difficult. And might sometimes feel as if it would be easier not to care about people. But at least in my experience, it's just not really possible. When you take that step back and try to see things as they are, the empathy just comes because you do see the suffering, and feel compassion. So the only way to avoid it, in a way, would be to live in illusion yourself, which I think in the end would almost certainly lead to more suffering.
Was that again? So I didn't get that last sentence.
I think the only way to avoid it, would just be to live in illusion yourself. To just keep trying to turn away. And I think in the long run, that would lead to even more suffering.
Mm-hmm.
oftentimes when I'm in a position of authority and dynamism of making stuff happen, say, there are other people around who may be tending carefully a flower. And so my effort can be, even though I'm, as I, you know, with energy, it can be probably perceived as cruel, you know, to not, because not to be tender to all. And I could imagine a guy in his position would be pushing big buttons all day. And there were probably some very sensitive people around him that, would have been how to justify it or accommodate both.
Yeah.
Carefully.
In the early days before Apple, I knew Steve, and he had kind of long hair and a bit of a beard. And he sat with us in Los Altos in the 70s. And he was a relatively nice guy. the thing about the liking the empty houses, that was my experience. We went to his house once, and he had this rather large suburban house that had virtually no furniture in it. It was just, the rooms were almost empty. It was very very sad-like. But then later, when Coben stayed in Woodside at the Jacqueline Estate, the Jacqueline Estate was one of the houses that Steve bought. But I don't think he actually lived there much. And finally he lived, after he got married, he lived in Palo Alto. And so he gave this house, he let Coben live in this house for many, many years, and that was Coben's residence. And it was, so it was a very nice support for Coben. And I met him a few times there at the Jacqueline Estate, and he was not so nice. he was kind of an arrogant guy. And Coben told me once that he emphasized to him that Coben could stay at his house, but he didn't want a lot of Zen students coming around. He didn't want it to be a place where Zen students hung out. I think he separated himself to some degree against these Zen students. A lot of Zen students were very poor, and he was very wealthy, so you can imagine that he got probably hit on a lot. Ryan Brandenburg was one of the people that tried to get money from Steve and kind of estranged him from him too. And I heard that other Zen students tried to hit up Coben. I'd hit up Steve for, you know, support. So I think he developed a kind of hard skin against that. He never, in the early days with Angie and so on, he never practiced here. Never. Never came up. But on the other hand, he was very supportive of the founding teacher, Coben. He was really, as well as providing a house, I think he also, for a time, he supported him, or partially supported him. So it's very, very good that way. But kind of good benefactor to our Dharma wheel.
I think we just have a few minutes before lunch, so maybe we should close there.